Welcome to Growing Up in America on KPFT Houston Pacifica Radio with our host from Children at Risk, noted child activist Dr. Bob Sanborn and policy expert Mandy Kimball. What do we have on tap today, Bob and Mandy?
All right.
Hello,
Don.
Happy Monday.
Mandy, you're Woo! Back in the saddle. You're like going at it, Mandy.
Yeah. And you too.
Yeah. How you doing?
You were the one that's been gone. I've been around.
We're back here together.
Yay!
Together again, finally, at last. Mm-hmm. It's Mandy and Dr. Bob.
There we go.
You ready for a good show?
Yes, I am.
Hey, we have all the interns, like some of the interns in the studio.
Right? I know.
Is that cool?
We're crowded around.
So, well, who do we have out
we
there?
We have to be really
Sarah,
good today.
We have Gina is out there. Alexa.
Alexa. That's right.
So,
shout out.
Yeah, they're all pretty good. They're like three of our best interns, aren't they?
We love the summer. Yeah, they're our three best until three more come next week.
Because we
and
always
then
have,
they're the three best.
Because we have 25 full-time interns during the summer. Really? No, literally.
This
I'm
is
not
true.
Even exaggerating.
True
it's just like a big deal. We have all these, this buzz. It's got, these are all sort of like activists in training, right?
It's true. They just want to learn from you, Dr. Bob.
From you, Mandy. Mandy is
we,
the great
We can
mentor.
Only try our best.
So you ready for the show?
Yes, let's do it.
So we're going to start off today's show, our data head today, one of our favorite staff members, Shay Everett. She is assistant director of the early education at the Center for Social Measurement and Evaluation. The number today from Shay as our data head, 40 million.
Get out of here.
Yeah, 40 million.
40 million.
What do you think that is? 40 million.
Stay tuned and
how many
find
kids,
out.
How many kids do we have in the United States? Let's ask Alexa.
All right.
Alexa, how many?
Ha, ha, ha. I'm sure she's never heard that before.
I know. I've already shared those jokes.
She's not laughing. Okay. And after our data head, we'll be talking with Robin Riegler, Executive Director of Writers in the Schools. And she'll be sharing information about the academically rigorous camps they offer throughout the summer to inspire young writers to pick up the pen and get creative.
I love Robin, right?
Yes.
So she'll be good to have on the show. Then we're going to talk with, this is a good one. We're going to talk with Dr. Jody Berger Cardoso. She's assistant professor at the University of Houston in the Graduate College of Social Work. And she's going to be talking with us about the psychological impact of family separation and reunification on immigrant children. Mandy, as you know, last week.
That's timely.
Yeah, last week we had big press conferences in Dallas and Houston on these immigrant children. And we'll talk a little bit about some of the stuff that's going on. But it's amazing, right, to me, this overwhelming support for ending this really stupid policy of family separation, right?
Yep.
And, you know, the president the president has not backed down on anything, but on this one, he saw the error of his ways. Of which there are many errors in his ways,
there
but at least
are.
He saw this one.
But, I mean, yeah, people really came out and said, this is not right.
Right.
The majority of people.
His own wife.
Still shocking
maybe
to
that
me
was the, maybe
is
that was
some people didn't disagree that it was a bad policy.
Yeah.
But anyways, that's why we just talk about it, educate.
This is why we had these big press conferences. That's why everyone showed up. But we got all this attention. But everyone got, a lot of people got attention on this.
But let's
one.
Talk about the impact that it has on these kids, right, and families moving forward.
It'll be
forward.
Good to have Dr. Cardoso.
Today on our social conscience scale, we want you to call in and give us your opinion, thumbs up or thumbs down. Should colleges and universities drop the SAT and ACT tests from their application process? What?
Yeah, I think this will be interesting, Manny, because I know that your score on the SAT was near perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we're now talking about eliminating those and just going with high school grades. Right? Should high school grades or interviews, should that be the determinant of whether you get into college? I mean, based upon just high school grades and interviews, you would have gone to Harvard.
Well, I mean, I just chose not to that one time.
I know.
This is not true. And that's not the point, right? However, this is a good conversation, and
no,
so I'm sure
so.
That
people
will have lots to say.
And I love this idea because so much of what we do in terms of getting into college is all about how you do on your ACT, how you do on your SAT. So what if we eliminated that,
right?
And colleges have, right? That's one of the things we're
many
seeing.
Many have.
Many colleges begin. They have been eliminating. More of them are eliminating.
But they do also allow schools to compare, or colleges, right, to compare apples to apples at times. That's the argument, right?
No,
that there's
no,
a standard,
like,
and how do people compare so they truly understand who's coming in the door for some.
Right, because you hear, what if my high school grade's harder than another high school?
Mm-hmm.
But this will make for a very rich conversation, I think, right? Yep. And you know what? I'm gonna ask the interns. I want them to start thinking about it now, because we'll ask the interns what they think about this.
Are y'all paying attention?
We'll get them on the mic, right, out mm-hmm. there in the control room, and we'll have them
give their opinion.
Not now, but when we get to this segment, right, which would be at the bottom of the hour.
There
should be
go.
Good. Hey, our final guest today is going to be Ann McAlpin. She's executive director of CASA, which are the child advocates, and she's from up in Montgomery County. She'll be joining us to talk about what they do over there. And we're going to talk specifically, Mandy, about foster care within the county and how having CASA on your side makes a big difference. Foster children, big issue here in Texas.
It is. And Texas has done some things to address the gaps and disparities that go on within foster care, but so much more to do. We need to rehaul the system. We're going to have a great show today.
It's going to be a wonderful show because Mandy's in the house.
And so Dr. Welcome, Bob.
Welcome to Growing Up in America here on Pacifica Radio. This is a discussion on children, public policy, politics, our future. How do we as a nation do when it comes to taking care of all of our kids? Are you ready for a little data head?
You know it.
I know. We are ready. So
that should be for writers in schools.
The poetry in motion.
Yes.
Yeah, it could be, right? Except it's because we're talking about Shay Everett.
Yeah, I know.
Poetry in motion. Right?
Hi, Shay
is poetry in motion, right? Shay, that's what like all your boyfriends say about you, right? Poetry in motion, right? Your parents say the same thing. Everyone who knows you pretty much says that, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So Shay, what is our big number today for Datahead?
40 million.
40 million. Bob was thinking children.
Children. 40 million children and
it's dollars.
It's dollars? Mm-hmm. You think it's dollars?
It's dollars.
Oh, of course. That's easier. So what are you thinking? What is it?
So it was just announced last week. This is the number of dollars that Governor Abbott and the Texas Workforce Commission are gonna invest in quality child care for 2019.
Well, that's good. An investment on the part of our state legislature. Sometimes that's hard to believe. What will this mean for families in Texas, Shay?
Well, right now, if you look at the current landscape, we have 15,000 child care providers in Texas, and only about 10% of them are part of any sort of quality certification, meaning that they're reaching higher quality standards than our state's minimum licensing standards, which are really low. And so this $40 million, it'll be hopefully every year, it's looking like. But for 2019, it'll go to a lot of great things, like improving partnerships with public pre-K programs at public schools and charter schools to kind of bridge that child care and elementary school gap and help get kids school ready. It'll also help child care providers who were impacted during Harvey. I was really happy to see that specifically
in
there.
Good. Mm-hmm.
You know, this is exciting. So forever now, it seems like, we have been talking about the importance of early education, and not just early education, but quality early education. And that could be child care or pre-K, mm-hmm. right? But unfortunately, I think that there's been a lot of focus on the pre-K sector and not of child care, where the bar is very low. So this is an opportunity for Texas to really increase access to affordable child care for families, for working families, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm glad that Texas, that TWC and the governor are maximizing the opportunity, because let's be real, Texas is getting what? An additional $240
million?
$229 million.
She knows the numbers.
There you go. So, and
so
goes right to quality.
Most of it is going to go towards serving kids and paying those providers that are quality. They're going to get paid more so that they are not losing money when they're serving these low-income working families and also trying to meet higher quality standards.
And I think this is just leveling out
yeah.
the playing field, because as parents who are listening right now, and if you have children in childcare and you pay for it, you know quality is expensive, right? Mm-hmm. And so the access piece is very important so that we can get all kids kindergarten ready, not just those who have the money to pay for it.
Shay, do you think there's a, based upon this, and we're talking about the Texas Workforce Commission sort of doling out some of this money to increase the quality of child care, do you think that the state is beginning to recognize that it's not just things don't just start in kindergarten or not even in pre-K, but they start much earlier? Is our state beginning to understand that the earlier you invest, the bigger your payoff?
I think our state leadership is, in terms of our governor and our state agency leadership.
Yeah.
But when it comes to public officials and our state legislature, I think there's still a good portion of them that don't, that maybe don't understand the science or believe the science, or maybe their personal ideals of baby staying at home with mom kind of trumps the what we know to be true, which is that parents have to go to work. And also that babies and toddlers' brains are developing at the most critical part of their entire life. And so we need to do, we need to start educating them early and not yeah. when they turn 4 or 5 or 6.
You know, people know what they know. And clearly, right, Bob?
That's pretty profound. But this right is there, Mandy.
This is something that legislators need to be educated on, like brain development, mm-hmm. right? So it's not just childcare and just safety, like are kids safe, but what is the brain development? What is the brain doing at that young age, and why is this so important? So there's that whole education piece. I will tell you, the legislators that you don't have to educate as much are the legislators whose wives were teachers
yeah.
and say, oh, we could definitely tell who had early child, you know, yeah. early child care and who didn't, and when they come into the schools. And so we've been lucky that there's some wives out there saying, husband, you know, this is important.
Well, even the former Speaker of the House, right? Mm-hmm. His mom was a public school teacher. Mm-hmm. He was hearing this over and over again. It's really interesting, isn't it,
yeah.
how this works. Shay Everett is at the Center for Social Measurement and Evaluation at Children at Risk. She is the Assistant Director of Early Education. Thank you, Shay, for all you do, and thanks for being on the program today.
All right, thanks.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. You're listening to Growing Up in America on KPFT Pacifica Radio. And Mandy, do your kids like to write? Kyler is like a little writer, isn't he?
He really likes to read. He does like to write. He likes to write stories. He likes to write comic books.
Probably
it depends.
It needs to be developed probably a little
bit,
right?
It does need to be developed a little bit more.
I think writers in the schools may mm-hmm. be for him, right?
Maybe so.
Maybe Kyler could be a paperback writer. On the line with us is Robin Riegler. Robin is the executive director of one of my favorite organizations in Houston, Writers in the Schools. Robin, how you doing?
I'm good, Bob. How are you?
Very good. It's been a long time, but
I
still talk about you all the time mm-hmm. and the great work that you guys are doing. So how's the summer shaping up for Writers in the Schools?
Well, we're having a great summer. We're working with so far, I think about 1,000 kids, and we have 2 more months to go, so it's very exciting. As you know, a lot of parents and educators worry about summer learning loss, the summer slide, they call it sometimes.
Yeah.
And so we do summer camps really in locations all over the city, and they're addressing that in a fun and academically rigorous way.
It's also, and Mandy has a good question, but Writers in the Schools is like a high-quality organization. I mean, Mandy and I have interviewed a lot of people over the years, and we visited a lot of programs around the country, right, that do interesting stuff. But what you guys are doing is extraordinary, and I'll give you just a little anecdotal. My daughter, back in the day, Mandy,
mm-hmm.
she did Writers in the Schools. And today, Robin, you don't know, she's a comedian in New York. She graduated from college and is now a comedian in New York. Don't you know those skills are still paying off for her today, right?
Mm.
Those writers and the school skills.
That is. So. Well, and it sounds like a fantastic program. But can you talk a little bit more of how you're introducing writing in an exciting and fun way? Because what my son likes to use his imagination, and he might write a superhero story or something, and then sometimes I talk to him and it's time to write, and he's like, no, it's boring. So how do you get kids psyched up to go to a camp where we're focusing on the writing?
Well, actually, the kind of writing your son likes to do is the kind of writing we like to do, too.
Mm-hmm.
And we start where children are. That's the first thing. And if it's superheroes, great. If mm-hmm. they want to write about, a fantasy, a unicorn, that's great. If they want to write a true story about their grandmother, that's also great. Whatever is exciting to them, it's like we're going to the things that they are passionate about, and that's where writing begins. It's also where reading begins. And so I talk to people a lot about, so what should my child be reading this summer? And my answer is, take them to the library if you can afford it, the bookstore, but let them find the thing that is exciting to them. The thing that speaks to them, both in terms of reading and writing, are going to get them to the place that you ultimately want your child to go to. And that's going to be writing about anything. But the place where we start is in the exciting place.
Robin, have you seen, we hear from so many people that, kids don't want to write anymore. Is there a difference from when you started doing this at Writers in the Schools to now in terms of the level of enthusiasm kids have for writing?
I would say no. And the reason, I think, is that kids like writing about themselves. They like thinking about themselves. And that way, they're just like us. We all, we all have this ego thing, and we're interested in what we're interested in. And so what we have found is that although there are lots of distractions today, the texting and the games and the things like that, there have been distractions at every moment in history.
Right.
Even for, the Little House on the Prairie people, it doesn't seem so interesting to us, but they loved going through the fields with that wheel and rolling it with a stick, and it was so exciting. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There are always sort of distractions and things that seem more interesting, but finally, we're talking usually about what kids do in school. And what kids do in school is getting the same answer as everybody else in school.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference when you're doing something like creative writing, when you're doing any kind of art, is that you are trying to get the answer that is perfect for you and only you, your story, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you think about your daughter, the comedian in New York City, she's writing, right?
Right.
She is getting off the bus. Somebody says something bizarre, and suddenly it's a story that she's going to tell in a club in 2 weeks. And so, really, those distractions are the same distractions at any point in time, but we all want to find a powerful way to tell our own personal story, and that is the thing that makes WITS exciting.
So, my turn.
Go on, Mandy. It's okay.
Bob is really excited to talk to you, Robin. But things have changed a bit. So maybe the desire there is the same. But how children are telling stories or writing, has that changed a bit? So we've been talking about the summer, but I know that you have a year-round program in the schools around creative writing and digital storytelling. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes. And we actually have a digital storytelling camp in August. So it's coming up. It'll be the last one. We've done a couple. But in the digital storytelling projects, kids are using technology to tell those stories. And, again, it's really about going to where they are. Their stories are exciting to them, but the ways that they tell those stories through video, through podcasts, through video games, those are the new things. And we really are trying to capture that enthusiasm by helping them learn these kind of 21st century skills. So in the digital camp that we do in August, it will be kids taking a story or a poem or an essay that they've written and literally converting it into a video game. So the premise is that every game is actually a story.
Right.
Think about Candyland. Think about Monopoly. Think about, you remember, the Game of Life? Chess. Chess is like that. They're all stories, and video games are the same, right? You are a character. You have conflicts. You have problems. You have to solve those problems. You have enemies. All the conflicts that would happen in a story also happen in the game. And so what we're doing in those digital projects is they take a story, they take a true life experience, and make a game out of it. And what happens is we're using technology in which other kids can actually play the games once the kids publish the games. And they give feedback, and they learn things. So, for example, we had a boy who was recently diagnosed with scoliosis. Well, he wrote an essay about it, right? It was going to be, it will be his college entrance essay, right? But is that a game? Well, I hadn't thought of it before, but in fact, he made it into a game.
Wow.
Right? And so in level one, you're limping, people start telling him. You're limping, you know, and he goes to the doctor, and he gets bad diagnoses, and then finally a correct diagnosis. Treatment path one didn't work. Treatment path two didn't work. Eventually, he wears a brace. And so for the kids who are playing his game, they learn, like, they've always seen kids wearing those braces on their legs, and they wonder, like, I wonder why that is. But you're not supposed to ask, right? Not appropriate. And so the game gives other kids a sort of inside experience of what it's like to have this situation and to be in this condition.
How old do you, what's the age on this particular camp, this digital learn?
That one is going to be older elementary and middle school.
Oh, wow. Because I could just see Mandy's son, Kyler, wanting to create an Alamo game.
Yeah.
He loves the Alamo. He's going to write stories about the Alamo.
He would.
Robin, tell people, parents that are out there, if they want to get their kids involved in Writers of the Schools, whether it's now or during the school year or next summer, where's your website and what do they need to do?
Go to our website. It's witshouston.org. That's witshouston.org. And we have a big banner on the front page that says camp. If you're interested in summer programming, there's another section that says for parents. And parents can go to that section. There's another section for schools. If you're a teacher, in our school programs, the students do not pay. The school pays instead. So those are free programs. And we work in every kind of school imaginable. So we'd love to hear from listeners and get in touch.
And do you have a book that parents should recommend for their kids? And any age is fine, but that people may not know about, but you find it's particularly good that you want some kids to read this summer?
My kids are reading Wildwood, and it's just a fantasy story, but my kids have read it several times and loved it.
Wildwood.
It would be for older elementary school and sort of middle school ages. That's a kid. That's my kid's age.
Yeah.
But lots of fun.
And are kids still reading Harry Potter like they were?
Yes. They are. They really are.
Yeah,
it's not gotten old.
Yeah, I was just in London, and I just saw the two, you know, Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. So
Yeah, great.
Yeah, it was pretty good. So a lot of theater up there. Robin Riegler is Executive Director of Writer in the Schools. Robin, thank you so much for the work that you do, and thank you so much for being on Growing Up in America today.
Thank you for having me.
All righty.
Bye.
Care.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
You're listening to 90.1 KPFT Pacifica Radio. This is Growing Up in America with Mandy and Dr. Bob. Mandy, this week was the big week on that we did press conferences last week.
Last week, yes.
A lot of work going on the borders. And I guess what's going on with getting someone on the line? Yeah. They're going wild. So when we think about our children at the borders. I mean, obviously, these kids are going through a lot of hardship, especially these kids that have been separated.
Oh, absolutely. And just think of how hard it was to get there, mm-hmm. right? And not just like physically getting there, but the circumstances that they were before they decided that they needed to leave. And that's where I got most frustrated, is that historically, when families or people are in dangerous situations and gangs and threats and, you know, domestic violence and rape, as a human being, it's fight or flight, right?
Yeah.
And if you can get out of the situation, that's what you do. And to be denied at our border is just heartbreaking. And then at the same time, take your kids away.
Separate from your families. Well, that's why we wanted to bring in Dr. Jody Berger Cardoso. She's an associate professor at the University of Houston in the Graduate College of Social Work. So many people have recommended Jody to us. Jody, how are you doing today?
Hi, good afternoon, everyone.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
So, Dr. Cardoso, when we look at what's happening on our borders, and, you know, we had a couple of press conferences at Children at Risk last week in Dallas and in Houston, and one of the things we're trying to bring attention to is sort of the plight of these kids and what they're going through. So when you think about their psyche and the trauma that they're experiencing, what's it doing to these kids, Jody?
So they bring with them a whole host of trauma exposures in their lifetime. My research with unaccompanied minors, for example, shows that on average, youth experience 8 traumatic events in their life, and these youth are only 14.
Wow.
And this is mostly even before they get to the United States. And then there's a whole host of challenges with integration and going to school and poverty that they experience here. So these youth and families are arriving at the border already with very significant trauma exposure. And then they're going through a very stressful experience. They don't speak the language. They don't understand the culture or the context. But what they do believe is they have the right to seek asylum mm-hmm. at the U.S.-Mexico border. And many of these families are doing just that. They're arriving, and they're seeking asylum, and they're met with that procedural process by separation because they crossed illegally into the United States. And that exacerbates their previous trauma exposure and puts them at risk and increases their vulnerability to mental health problems like post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, anxiety, separation anxiety, and all of the other kinds of problems that we hear with kids who have chronic trauma exposure and during early childhood.
Dr. Berger Cardoso, do you think that the authorities at the border really understand what these kids are going through? I mean, are they oblivious to all of this and they're just sort of following orders? Or do you think there's an understanding of what these kids and their families have gone through and what state they're in?
I can't say with certainty because I haven't conducted any research interviewing border control or security people at the border. But If I had to guess based on what I know just about human beings, is that many of them probably feel very ambivalent about what's going on. Mm. They feel very torn. They have a job to do. The job requires them to implement policies, and those policies are not child and family focused, and they have very significant impacts on these families. And I'm sure that many, many people at the border feel quite ambivalent about what they're being instructed to do.
Absolutely. I can't imagine.
No.
And it's your job and you're told to do this. But if you are a parent or have any loved ones, it would be so hard to witness
you would think,
that.
Right?
Yeah,
you would think.
Yeah, you can't speak
right?
for
and
everyone.
In these border communities, they're used to the border, right?
Right.
It used to be that people came and went. They came across the border and went across the border very freely. And so many of these people have ties across the border. They speak Spanish or they mm-hmm. grow up in very transitional areas where their neighbors are from Mexico or from Central America. And so I would guess that they have a lot of ambivalence about what they're being asked to do, especially given the consequences of those actions.
So what kind of services and therapy do children need to help them get back on the right path? So if, and I'm not saying necessarily these children, but maybe we are, but the studies that you have done around unaccompanied children, I mean, can they make it? Can they get back? Clearly they have several obstacles in front of them.
They do, but what we know is that while they have really significant challenges, they have pretty miraculous resilience. I mean, if you can imagine traveling over 1,500 miles yeah. by yourself, right, to get and reunify with family with whom you haven't seen in a long time, and to do that all under the context of going to school every day, that demonstrates pretty significant resilience.
Mm-hmm.
Many people would shut down and would be unable to keep going there. And these kids really rise to the occasion. So while they have really experienced quite extensive trauma, they've also been able to really rise above and do some of the things that we see typical adolescent kids do. Now, I think that we could do better, right? We could give them the same benefits that we give citizen kids when we give citizen kids access to care. Unfortunately, in Texas, we know that mental health treatment is really not very accessible for U.S. citizen kids, much less immigrant kids, right? Generally, Texas is ranked like 49th in the nation for mm-hmm. mental health services.
Right, right.
So we have really a long way to raise the bar for everyone, right? But there are very good modalities that have been successful in reducing trauma symptoms in youth. Some of those modalities are trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, or TFCBT, we've used with kids exposed to long-term trauma. But we've also seen some success with cognitive behavioral intervention for trauma in schools, which is a group-based intervention that is rooted in TFCBT, but executed in a group format. And the point is that kids normalize these experiences for themselves in these group settings. And these models have shown to reduce post-traumatic stress symptoms, depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation. And so we do have a lot of knowledge about what works for kids exposed to long-term trauma. The question is, will we give kids access?
Mm-hmm. Jody, let me ask you one last question. We have talked extensively at Children at Risk and in our press conferences about the trauma of family separation. And so now that ostensibly our federal government is saying we're going to keep the kids with their parents, but we're going to incarcerate them, right? They're going to be detained. Is that indeed, I mean, if I'm a child, if I'm a 10-year-old child and separated from my mom, I know that's horrible. But now that I'm going to be detained with my mom and my dad, how much better is that for that child?
Research is really clear that family separation is not in the best interest of the child. We see that very strongly highlighted in the UN Convention of the Child. We also see very clearly articulated in the UN Convention that children should not, under any circumstances, be detained in detention centers for long periods of time, mm-hmm. for any period of time,
yeah.
but for undetermined periods of time. We know that detention on children increases their likelihood of post-traumatic stress disorder. It increases depression and anxiety in children. It also increases that in their parents, and parents who are more depressed and more anxious are less available emotionally and physically to their children, and that also impacts child mental health. There is no circumstance for which the research suggests that detention within the family system is better for kids than family separation. That is just another way to re-traumatize children and to take away the media focus on the separation piece. But really, detaining children, even in the context of the family unit, is still a violation of their human rights, and it goes against all research suggesting that such detention should be such detention has negative consequences, both short-term and long-term, for their mental health.
Well, it's obvious to us, right, that the best in, you know, having to do the best for our children, for our families, for these children, for these families, is not the intent of our administration.
Not the zero tolerance.
This is
policy.
Not a good thing. So, Jody, we thank you so much for your expertise in this area. And I hope that we can call on you again as this crisis continues, because it's not over, right? I think it's not over, and there's still a lot of work to be done. Jody Berger Cardoso is Associate Professor at the University of Houston at the Graduate College of Social Work. Thank you, Jody, very much for being on the program. Thank you for what you do.
Okay, take care, you guys. Thank you so much.
All right, bye-bye.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to
Go
Growing
Cougs.
Up in America. Yeah, that's where you went to the Graduate College of Social Work, didn't
I did.
You? Yeah. So are they Cougars? Is that the graduate school? I guess the
that's
whole
University
the whole
of Houston. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you go to all the football games and basketball games,
every
don't you,
every single one.
Because you're just like a big
big
old fan.
I do go. I go to them.
You have been?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I went to one once.
Great.
You gotta support the athletes, right?
There you go.
So, Mandy, are you ready to move on?
Yes.
You ready to do a little bit of thumbs up, thumbs down? Yeah, very good. So, what is, you ready for thumbs up, thumbs down? And let's go.
Wait for the music. Here's your boom.
Boom.
There you go.
There it is. There's the boom right there.
All right. So, today we are talking about, should colleges and universities do away with the SAT and AC tests from their application process? So we thumbs up, thumbs down to SAT, ACT. Let us know, 713-526-5738, 713-526-5738.
And our good buddy Patrick is on the line, right?
So wonderful.
Yeah, we love Patrick, right?
We do.
So Patrick is also at the Center for Social Measurement Evaluation. Pat, how you doing, man?
I'm great. How are you, Dr. Park?
Very good. So tell us, I know that you talked in our staff meeting a little bit this morning, Patrick, about this issue. And what does the research say about colleges and universities and those that dropped SAT, SAT?
Well, so there's a few different lenses the research kind of looks at it through. First, kind of like the why do colleges make this decision? And there's a few reasons behind that. One is that, I mean, the research pretty consistently shows that high school GPA is a better indicator of college success, is more closely associated with how well you're going to do in college than your test scores. So just in general, it doesn't give the best picture of how well a student is going to do in college. So that's why some colleges have gone away from it. There's also, to put some numbers to that, if you're a student in the top income quartile and you scored between an 800 and a 999 on the SAT, so didn't get a great SAT score,
this
is out of 1600, you are still more likely to graduate from college than a student in the bottom income quartile that scored between 1,200 and 1,600 on the SAT.
Wow.
So how many
colleges have done this where they've eliminated the SAT or ACT requirements? Do you know off the top, Patrick? Do you know, Mandy?
It's about 700.
I'm looking at it. There's over 1,000 colleges and universities
that have eliminated the SAT, ACT. That's a big deal.
Well, that don't require it.
Yeah, it's
optional, usually. So some students do submit it. And it's, of those 700, about 300 are considered top tier by the U.S. Citizen World Report annual rankings.
And you went to Notre Dame. Did Notre Dame have SAT, ACT, Patrick?
Yes, Notre Dame did require it. Notre Dame is not one of the ones who have eliminated it.
So then oftentimes, right, if they weren't going to do that, they were going to go off of your high school record, and then they probably do an interview or an essay, or then look at, you know,
high school grades. The best indicator of how you're going to do
volunteerism,
in college.
Like, what did you do?
All those things are important, but high school grades are the best indicator, according to all the research.
Mm-hmm.
What you do in high school is the best indicator of how you're going to do in college. And what college admissions people are trying to do when they have all these other things, sort of round out the picture. They know that not all schools are the same, but in general, that high school, that the grade point average that you have in high school, in general, and this is according to the research, Patrick, you with me on this?
I am with you.
Compared to a white suburban school to an inner city mostly minorities, poverty. They're going to say it will be the same.
Wherever you go to school, in general, the best indicator. Now, one of the things that admissions officers know is, you know, this school compared to this other school, they know what the rigor is. So they're going to have an idea.
And this is what I'm just asking. So Texas has the 10%, right?
Yes.
Top 10%.
Yes.
And so that's controversial. And what'd you say?
It's top
8%.
Now.
Top 8% here recently. That's right.
Yeah, UT. Yeah.
So that is to give everyone, you know, more of an equal opportunity.
Right. No matter where you go to school, if you're in the top 8%, you can get into UT.
But what I am understanding is that some of those kids who are in the top 8% of those, you know, F schools or underperforming schools are not doing well at all at those universities. And in fact, they're having to do a lot of hand-holding.
You know, that's incorrect. What the results show is that kids, no matter where they have gone to high school, when they go to UT or A&M or Texas Tech, that they're actually doing quite well. And yes, maybe some hand-holding has to go on in terms of getting those kids to graduate, but they are doing quite well. And by and large, across the country, people look at this. What we thought at one point was a bad idea, this 10% rule, they've looked at it.
I always thought it was a great idea. I just thought it wasn't working out as they thought it was going to.
It's actually working out quite well, Patrick.
Do you agree with him, Patrick?
Yeah, I do. And I think what it speaks to is, I think calling it hand-holding is kind of the wrong way to frame it. I think it's looking at, these are students that have shown that they can be successful when given the opportunity, and so it's up to universities to provide them the resources they need to have those same opportunities when they get to their campuses. So, UT Austin is actually one of the national leaders in establishing programs for students from lower income or more at-risk backgrounds in terms of making sure that they're providing mentoring opportunities and classes that will give them the support that they need, which has helped them be really successful. So they've seen there's work being done at UT Austin where really simple interventions that take like a matter of minutes can close the achievement gap between lower income students and higher income students by between 30% and 40%. So it's pretty astounding what UT has been able to do thanks to the top 8% rule.
All right, hold on with us, Patrick. We're going to take some phone calls. 713-526-5738. 713-526-5738. Thumbs up or thumbs down? Should we be eliminating admission tests like the SAT and the ACT? Thumbs up if you like the SAT. Johnny, you're on the line. How you doing, Johnny?
Well, my question is, do people like George W. Bush, was he required to take an SAT or ACT? And more importantly, did the Ivy League he go to, did they require that, or did they ignore that and just go by his daddy, the legacy admission?
So he had to take that, but then your second point is right? He was a legacy. And there are still significant schools in the Ivy League and other high-performing schools that do have legacies, Johnny, right? Which is your point, is that sometimes, if you're born to the right family, it doesn't matter, right? We basically have eliminated the SAT requirement for you because you were born to a certain parent, right?
Uh-huh.
That's true.
Yeah.
All right.
And if you're not a gifted test taker or a genius like Mandy, you're in trouble.
Johnny,
you're on the right
team now, man.
Yeah, my
favorite. Everybody up. Have a good day.
All right, Johnny.
Take care, man.
713-526-5738, 713-526-5738.
Are we asking interns?
Yeah, I'm going to ask Gina. Gina, what do you think on this one? And Gina is a star student from Middlebury, the Institute over at Middlebury in California. Is that right? Did I get that right, Gina?
Yes, you got that right.
Okay, very good. What do you think on this one, Gina? Thumbs up or thumbs down to the SAT?
I say thumbs down to standardized testing.
Yeah.
Well, because I took the SAT twice, and the first time I did mediocre, and then my parents paid for a test prep course, and then I did way better. So if I hadn't had my family hadn't had the money to pay for that course.
You had an advantage. I
definitely had an advantage.
And where did you do undergraduate, Gina?
At Trinity University in San Antonio.
Right. And so that extra test prep, which people don't often get, was the difference for you. And really, it would have been nice for colleges just to be able to go by your grades, right, Gina?
Yeah, I think so.
Instead of having to spend the money. How about Sarah? I want to talk to Sarah a little bit. Sarah is one of our interns, and Sarah goes to UT. And Sarah, when you think about this idea of taking the test. What do you like, thumbs up or thumbs down on these tests?
I say thumbs down to getting rid of the standardized testing.
You like the tests?
Well, the reason is because I understand the arguments for getting rid of it, definitely. But feel like GPA is a better measure. But the problem is that it depends on what school you're coming from. So if you're coming from a school where the top 10% is equivalent to the top 1% of another school, it's just hard to measure and compare.
Yeah, but you just never know what neighborhood you live in and what school you're going to get to. Yeah, so thanks, Sarah, very much. Let's take another phone call, and then we're going to come back to intern Alexa. Courtney, you're on the line. How are you doing today, Courtney?
Doing all right. How about yourself?
Doing super well.
Happy Monday.
So thumbs up or thumbs down on these tests, Court?
Thumbs down. I definitely think that the previous caller, she was correct in that the schools are not the same. Everyone's not on the same page. And the SAT is a much more broad spectrum to test the students to see where they fall and to see exactly where they're at.
So you like the idea of taking these SAT tests, Courtney?
Yes, I do. I mean, I had a decent GPA in high school, but I was busy and I had a lot of things going on. And I did very well on the SAT, and then I struggled but made it through college. I mean, it's just the way it is.
And where'd you go to college, Courtney?
I'm sorry, go ahead?
Where did you go to college?
I went to Texas A&M.
Yeah, very good, very good. So, and you made it, graduated there. Hey, Courtney, thanks for calling in, man.
I appreciate it.
All righty, take care. Let's see. And so we have Alexa. Alexa, what are you thinking on this? You like this idea of testing? Alexa, we got Alexa.
Yes.
What do you think about the idea of testing, Alexa?
I don't really like the idea of testing.
So you're thumbs down on the testing thing. You're with me instead of with Mandy, I guess, right?
Yes.
Of course.
You haven't even asked me if I'm thumbs up or thumbs down.
What are you thinking, Mandy?
You know, I think it's interesting that the two arguments, one is like SAT, like those who are for the SAT is more... It gives the more privileged an advantage.
It does. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then for the records, you were saying that it gives other people an advantage. So there's got to be somewhere in between. It's not, neither is quite fair, actually, in my opinion.
Well, right. I mean, but you look for the fairest, right, is what you have to do. Yeah. And so I appreciate it when colleges look at everything, right? They try to look at the whole package. Mm-hmm. But I think many colleges are trying to make this statement that SAT does have something, you know, if you're able to do like Gina and pay and get a test prep, you get a little advantage, right?
You do.
And that means if you can afford to take the test prep, then now you're getting an advantage. So when a college eliminates that, they're saying, let's eliminate a privileged advantage in a sense. And they're eliminating part of the picture for them,
right?
But they're trying to make a statement. And I'm all for that.
Yep.
Yeah. So,
there you go.
Interesting stuff, right?
Yep.
Thumbs up. Thumbs down.
I'm a little bit on the fence. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, because you're thinking I like to see the whole package, right?
Yeah, I want the whole package.
Yeah. And if you can get your kids to pay for a test prep, you're okay with that, right?
So that's not what I'm saying.
I know. I'm just riling you up.
You are.
This is why people listen to our show, Mandy, because I get to rile you. While the genius,
and then they're just
Mandy
like,
Kimble.
Oh, that jerk.
Yeah, that's what they're thinking. Like, oh, come on, Dr. Bob. That's ridiculous.
Oh,
so, are you ready to move on to our next guest?
I am.
Do we have a little theme music for our guest?
Thanks, Patrick.
Yeah, thank you very much, Patrick. So. I love that song, right? Hey, with us on the line is Ann McAlpin. She's the executive director of CASA, the Child Advocates of Montgomery County. Ann, how are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
Very good.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for joining. How's the weather way up north in Montgomery County?
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, can't make up its mind if it's going to be stormy or sunny. It's like 1 minute it's sunny, and the next minute you just might get deluged.
I think it hailed today.
Did it hail today in Montgomery County or in Houston?
No, in Houston.
Oh, really? Wow. Very good. So, Ann, I wanted to talk a little bit about the work that you guys do with foster children, because when we look at the state, right, we see in many ways, when we talk about children, the issue of foster children is one of the biggest areas for improvement in the state of Texas. And is that sort of how you feel about it as well?
Well, we don't look at it so much from a big system perspective as how we can change the life of each child, one child at a time. Yes, there are things that need to be changed in the system. All the folks that we work with within the system are, you know, well-intentioned, but even with a whole system working with an attorney for the child and a CPS worker devoted to that child and a judge who hears the case regularly, things tend to fall through the cracks and children get placed in places where they're not safe and certainly not loved. And that's what we want to do at CASA, is make sure that every child is placed somewhere where they're safe and they're loved as soon as possible.
Well, and I can't say too many good enough things about CASA. What the program and the lives that you change and ensure that children are safe is just remarkable. And thank you very much. And, you know, Bob, we talk about children at risk and research and advocacy and being a voice for kids, which we are to a different audience. But CASA is right there when serious decisions at that moment are being made. You truly are a voice and a support system for those kids. So thank you so much.
You need to use that in your next ad and just have Mandy to speak for you.
I'm scribbling furiously.
It is just fantastic, though. But, you know, can you talk a little bit about that? I'm glad that you're here, and everyone loves kids, and everyone wants to help kids, and CASA really works off of volunteers, correct? That you train volunteers to come in to the system. So if you're a caring person, that could be a lot of weight and responsibility. Oh, I want to help kids, but I don't want to be responsible if something goes wrong. What do you have to say to the greater Houston area people who are listening on why they should get involved?
Okay, it is a responsibility. There is no doubt about that. It is a heavy responsibility. But there is no volunteer opportunity available at which you have as great a chance to change a child's life as you do being an advocate. People tell me all the time that they don't think they could do it because they would get too emotionally involved. And we say, good, get emotionally involved. You want to be involved. And then you'll be and then on top of that, you have a layer of objectivity. It's one of the reasons why we get paid attention to is the objectivity, but I guess I'm getting a little off track here. What I want to say is people should volunteer because you can change a child's life, and we will be there to help you with the responsibility. We have paid staff whose job it is to make sure that it's not overwhelming for the volunteers, who will go with you to court, who will help you with additional training, who will go with you to the child's home if you're not comfortable going by yourself. So we will help and we will support, but you will be the one who's front line talking to the teachers, the doctors, the therapists, having the relationship with the child and making a real difference for each child that you work with.
What are some of the key presenting problems, Anne? I mean, what's the biggest problem that you see each and every day with kids?
Well, that's a big question.
Yeah, I know.
What we work hardest at, and it's going to be different with each child, but we work hard to make sure that whatever it is the child is getting is not falling through the cracks. And it could be different with each child. Just for example, we have an education committee that works with all the advocates to make sure that they know where the resources are so they can work with them on their education. While a child is in the foster system, the chances are good that they're going to be changing schools twice a year if they're in the system more than a year. And you know, every time they change schools, they lose some on their education. So here's an example. An advocate that we had thought that something was wrong, that the child needed additional help. The child was 8, and the schools told her that, told the advocate that the child was just slow and would be in special education classes and just get used to the idea. Well, this advocate thought there was something more, because the child was doing okay in other subjects, but he couldn't read. And she persisted until she got him a professional assessment, and it turned out that that child had Erlen's syndrome. Do y'all know Erlen's syndrome?
No.
It makes the words appear as if they're either knots or they're running across the page. It's not visually possible to read if you have that syndrome. But the cure for it is as simple as putting the right color transparency on top of the pages that you're reading, or wearing the glasses with the right color tint.
Yes.
And the words become real words. And so that child learned to read because the advocate said something is wrong and we need to get an official assessment.
Yeah.
Wow.
We see the same thing with therapy. A child, their plan very often, particularly if it was sexual abuse, but very often any case of abuse, the child's plan is going to include therapy. And it gets put on the plan, and what happens, not all the time, but sometimes it happens that the therapist is busy or they're full up with their state patients, and the child just doesn't actually get the therapy. Well, our advocate can go, she can go to CPS and be charming and make sure that it actually happens. And if we don't, if we're not able to get the, to make it happen through that channel, then that she can go back to court and get the judge to order it. And then it always happens.
It sounds like it's really about stepping up and being a community, right? What you're talking about is something that any mother and father would do for their kids. But unfortunately, these children are in a difficult situation, and they don't have that angel looking over their shoulder, right? So it is a responsibility, but something that everyone can handle to ensure that kids are safe and move
That's
forward.
That's very well said.
Yeah.
Nobody, even the best workers in CPS, would say that the state is a good parent for children.
Yeah, that's absolutely that's right. True. Ready to do our final F54 with Ann?
Yes, Ann. So this is an opportunity for listeners to get to know you a bit better. So we have four questions. First question is, what was your favorite toy to play with as a kid?
Oh, it was a Dr. Spit. I loved playing doctor. Oh.
Doctor!
Did you have a little white jacket as well, Ann, that you could wear?
I totally did. Yeah. And a little plastic stethoscope. When I was coming along, I'm sure the toys were less sophisticated than they are now, but I had a good time being the doctor.
And you're still healing lives. And what did you want to be when you were growing up?
I thought that I wanted to be a concert pianist. And I thought I was going to wow the world with my music. I didn't turn out doing that, but I still have a good time.
And you're still wowing the world. You can, that's good.
Do you play the piano? Yes?
I do.
That's good. That's good. What was your favorite book to read as a child?
Oh, my goodness. The Velveteen Rabbit. Am I getting that?
Yeah.
That was my favorite book.
Little book. And what
I
was
read
your...
that over and over. I made them read it to me over and over until I could read it myself, and then I read it over.
You memorized it. So our final question today is, what was your favorite TV show when you were a kid?
I loved Father Knows Best. I lived close enough to my school, my elementary school, that I could ride my bike to school and I could ride home at lunch. So I would get on my bike, pedal as fast as I could, go home and watch Father Knows Best while I ate lunch, and then pedal back to school before lunch was over.
Wow.
Were you skipping school, or they just let you go?
No, they let us go home for lunch then.
Wow, back in the day. That's back in the day.
Back in the day.
That was like a little... She was living in Pleasantville at the time, so it's just this little town.
Pretty much.
Yeah, wow, very good.
That's awesome.
Thank you, Ann, very much. Ann McAlpin is Executive Director of CASA, the Child Advocates of Montgomery County. She does some great work. Thank you, Ann, for all that you do, and thank you for being on Growing Up in America.
And thank you. We appreciate you.
All right.
Thanks. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, Mandy, that brings us up to another day, right?
Another show, another day.
Another week of activism for children, right?
That is true.
We just keep doing the work, right?
Yeah.
We have a lot of great people doing this work with us at Children at Risk. We have a lot of people here in the studio helping us. Of course, Don is our engineer. We got old Shannon working with us, producing the program. McCurchy is doing a great job. We always enjoy having her.
She
it's good
is.
To have her back here, right?
Mm-hmm.
She's helping us out with this as well. So, Mandy, our podcasts, they're available, I think, if you want to listen to Growing Up in America, you get the podcasts. And I know a lot of people who love these podcasts.
Maybe I'll listen to it. So I'm about to go out of town, right, to Lake Charles.
Yeah, so you can listen to a couple. Yeah. You know, I have a funny story. I had my mom listen to one, and she 20 minutes in, she goes, when are you going to be on? I go, Mom, that was me. This has been me the whole time with Mandy. So anyway, hey, hug your kids. Take care of kids in your own community. We do this for children. And so thank you so much for all that you do. We'll see you next time here on Growing Up in America here on Pacifica Radio.